Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Monica Goodling is testifying before Congress as we speak. We will have some clips of that to share with you as we go on through the program and fill you in on what's going on there. The Democrats saying to the Republicans, basically, okay, guys, you want a war? Step up and vote for it, because we're getting out of the way. You know, Bush keeps vetoing these things. We can't stop it. We can't make it happen. Well, we'll discuss that as we go on through the day as well. We're going to have Larry Johnson on with us from formerly the CIA and the State Department. Larry Cox is going to be with us about a human rights report. He's the executive director of Amnesty International. A lot going on in the over the next 3 hours. Right now, Yaron Brook is with us, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, the website. And Yaron, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Where I wanted to go with this is the Chavez, Hugo Chavez, has this in the news. I mean, this is internationally, this is hot news. Chavez saying that the oil companies that have been pumping oil out of from under the ground in Venezuela are not going to get 100% of the money that they've been getting up to this point. He's basically buying them down to 60%. Part of it he's taking. He's just saying, hey, you know, this is our oil, and I'm guessing that you think that that's a bad idea.
Oh, definitely. I don't think there is such a thing as our oil. I don't own the oil in Texas. I believe that all property should be private property. And the oil that was discovered in Venezuela was discovered by individuals, by individual companies or individual people. They might have sold those rights, but the rights today are owned by specific corporations like Chevron. And they have property rights over that oil. What he's doing is theft. It's nothing less than stealing. You know, stealing that happens every day in America as well. Our government is guilty, but here it's done on a massive scale to the detriment of not only the Venezuelan people, but the owners of these corporations, the shareholders.
What he's doing is essentially the same thing that Saudi Arabia did when they nationalized Aramco.
Absolutely.
The same thing that the Kuwaitis did. It's the same thing it's the same thing that Saddam did. It's the same thing that the Iranians did. I mean, it's been done over and over again in oil-rich countries. The Russians are doing this right now. I mean, they're deprivatizing some of their oil that was briefly privatized.
You're right. I mean, I think that's exactly the point. Look at what a mess the Middle East is in. I actually believe that the beginning of all our problems in the Middle East go back to the fact that we allowed this nationalization to happen unchallenged.
But if you look at the countries where it hasn't happened, look at, for example, Nigeria, where you know you've got the Shell Oil and you know pumping oil out and saying this is our oil and we'll pay small royalties to the nation, but we're taking the oil. And there you have this incredible, massive, widespread poverty as the wealth that is literally under the ground of the people who are sitting on the ground, as they're starving to death, the wealth that is under the ground is being taken out by a multinational corporation and sold to other companies and countries.
But to the extent that Nigerians are poor, it has nothing to do with these oil companies.
But they're sitting on riches.
It's quite the contrary. The fact is that the oil companies create enormous opportunities. The poverty in Nigeria is a direct consequence of the economic and political and corruption of their own government. There are billions and billions and tens and hundreds of billions flowing into the Nigerian government and disappearing, just like in most of these African countries.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that, but it's
the lack of capitalism in Nigeria.
No, it's the lack of a democratic process.
I encourage people to read a book by the writings of De Soto, who is a South American economist, and he talks about how granting the poor property rights, granting the poor property rights and respecting those property rights is the way out of poverty for these countries. That is capitalism.
Okay, so if
the
we
way
have
out of poverty for countries like Nigeria,
if we have a bunch of poor people who have been granted property rights, and let's say that they each own their own home and collectively it covers 50 square miles, and there's oil under those 50 square miles, don't they all collectively own that oil?
Well, I think that each one of them, whoever owns a piece, absolutely. If you own ground and there's oil under your ground, you should own the
so,
oil.
So my company comes.
So
here you have rights. Chevron has come along and they've tapped into this giant pool of oil that extends under much of Venezuela. And they're saying, this is our oil. And Venezuela is saying, no, it belongs to the people who are sitting on the ground above it.
Absolutely not. They discovered the oil. They dug for it. There was no property rights to find.
So if I discover oil under your property or a pool of oil that is under both your house and my house, and I suck it dry, tough luck to you because I discovered it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean these are issues that were analyzed and defined during the boom years of oil in Texas and Oklahoma in the early 20th century, and property rights were defined accurately about who gets what.
And what
and
that led
Venezuela,
to was the rise of the robber barons and massive poverty in the United States.
Venezuela wants to promote a property rights-based oil exploration and revenues, then I'm all for that. But that's not what Venezuela is doing. What Venezuela is doing is the government is confiscating that oil, and that money is going to disappear. But it's the government. The government has
that money is funding hospitals. That money is funding housing.
It makes no difference. The government has no business in the oil business. The government needs to butt out of property.
It is a natural resource that's under the ground of everybody in that country.
That's not true. If you want to define it's not true. It's only under the ground in certain regions. If you want to define property rights in Venezuela for particular specific individual Venezuelans who have the right.
I am talking about property rights. I'm talking about the collective property rights of society.
There's no such thing as collective property rights.
There's certainly
only. There's only property rights.
We are a social animal, Yarn. We create societies. We
are social animals only to the extent that we benefit from trading with one another, and trade trade is assumed the idea that each of us owns his own property.
See, I would submit to you, Yarn, that we're talking with Yarn Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and whatnot, the founder of objectivism, which has in some ways been a major inspiration to the libertarian movement and to the conservative and neoconservative movements, although I realize that you disavow all of them.
All of them.
None of them are radical enough for you. And because they all believe in some, I suppose, some form of government.
Well, the libertarians, in a sense, are too radical for me. I don't believe in anarchy. I believe in a strong government, but a government that only does one thing, and that is protect individual rights, because only individual rights exist. There's no.
But how can you even have a government that's protecting individual rights if that government isn't reflecting an entire society?
Well,
you said there's no such thing as
society. It reflects the rights of every individual. I mean, that's the foundation of the establishment of the U.S. government. It was the idea that we all have inalienable right to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness, and the government is set up.
No, Jefferson took property out of that John Locke quote when he put it in the Declaration of Independence.
And that's it. The role of the government is to protect those rights and butt out not to own property, not to own industries, not to manage the economy, but to protect us from fraud and from violence. That's it.
So you're submitting that the only purpose that the reason why the only purpose for government should be basically the punitive one, the protecting property, protecting individual property rights, or restraining evil individuals from acting out.
Absolutely. That is what enables
the flow. That the reason for that is because you don't acknowledge that there is something known as a larger society. What about family? What about clan? What about tribe? Right. What about community? What about town? What about county? I mean, at what point does it cease to exist as society for you, Yarn?
Look, societies exist, but only as groups of individuals. If you deny individual rights,
aren't we as a nation a group of individuals?
Everybody, once you deny individual rights, everybody suffers. I believe that government should do what I defined it do, because human progress depends on in the individual mind. The individual mind flourishes under freedom. What government is instituted.
And the history of all that is that the individual mind flourishing collectively. I mean, we do these things together. We backstop each other.
That's right. When we voluntarily cooperate with one another, and indeed the human
and that's
mind
called society.
Is constrained when we place boundaries on it, boundaries placed by governments.
All right, Yaron Brook, IanRand.org. Thanks, Yaron.
Always fun.
Indeed. It's always interesting. Anyway, 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Monica Goodling, what's she up to, and what's going on with the Democrats in Congress? And, well, frankly, with the Republicans on Congress. Let's start pinning the tail on the right donkey here. Pun intended.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Just want to bring us back to this larger issue of the needs and values of society versus the needs and values of individuals or private corporations. And there is a, in addition to, you know, what we're seeing in Venezuela where Chavez is saying, hey, wait a minute, we the people own this oil, not you, an American oil company. And so we're going to take our oil back. A bunch of other countries have done the same and said, thank you very much. But, you know, this is our oil. We can do this. At the same time, there is a absolutely incredible and dramatic and fundamental realignment of corporate power going on in the United States today. And it is being discussed regularly in writ large, actually, in the financial press. If you read the Financial Times of London, if you read the Wall Street Journal, there's articles about this almost every day. And yet the average American, I think, is completely unaware that it's even happening and doesn't understand the significance of it. If people hear stories like, and this again gets into this whole thing about at what point do society's needs versus private individuals, or in this case private corporations, a group of individuals, collide. Alltel, this is from the Wall Street Journal. Alltel, a wireless phone company, agreed last night to be sold to a consortium of private equity firms for $27.5 billion, marking the largest buyout ever in the telecommunications industry. This is the largest public company to seek to go private amid the frenzy of deal-making among private equity firms. Why are all these private equity firms doing this? Why are they buying this, you know, the Blackstone deal? China putting $3 billion into Blackstone. Why? Well, I've been digging into this for the last couple of days. I make a bunch of phone calls and track down some people who really knew about this. And what I found is that it's because of Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley was the reform that was put into place after the collapse of Enron that said that if you are a publicly traded corporation, you have an obligation to the public because the public authorizes your existence and the public can own shares in your company. And so if the president of the corporation lies in the financial statements, he has to sign off on them. He can personally go to jail. It was the anti-Ken Lay law. It required transparency. So what's happening now is all these companies that were public are going private. They're being bought out by private equity firms, so they no longer come under the purview of Sarbanes-Oxley. It's really pretty mind-boggling. At the same time, Monica Goodling now testifying, and how do I make that segue here? Well, it's fairly simple. We're talking about corporate power, and corporate power is what the Republican Party is all about, is sucking up to corporate power and making sure that those people who are not part of the power structure in America, the poor, the average working person, the middle class, the particularly minorities across the United States, are excluded from the electoral process. Monica Goodling talking, actually using the word caging in her testimony, which is this illegal practice that the Republican Party has been operating for over 20 years under a restraining order preventing them from doing. And she mentions caging in her testimony. Here's the beginning of her testimony. I'm going to play a little more of it after the break at the bottom of the hour. But Monica Goodling before
my written
Congress.
Remarks will address four topics that I expect will be of interest to the committee. First, I wish to set the record straight regarding what I understood to be the Deputy Attorney General's allegation to Senator Schumer that I withheld information from him prior to his public and private testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The allegation is false. I did not withhold information from the deputy. To the contrary, I worked diligently to compile and provide the deputy with dozens of pages of statistics and other information that I thought he was likely to need based on the questions that were being asked at that time.
Does that sort of remind you of the rats bailing out of the sinking ship? I'm telling you, that's what's going on here.
Despite my and others' best efforts, the deputy's public testimony was incomplete or inaccurate in a number of respects.
Here she's calling basically her boss a liar.
As explained in more detail in my written remarks, I believe the deputy was not fully candid about his knowledge of White House involvement in the replacement decision, failed to disclose that he had some knowledge of the White House's interest in selecting Tim Griffin as the interim U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Arkansas.
Okay, Tim Griffin. Now, first of all, she's talking about Paul McNulty. He's the deputy attorney general, the number two guy under Gonzalez. And she's telling them that he lied to Congress. And it, particularly he lied about Karl Rove's protege, Tim Griffin. This is the Karl Rove guy that they were going to get in.
And accurately described the department's internal assessment of the Parsky Commission and failed to disclose that he had some knowledge of allegations that Tim Griffin had been involved in vote caging during his work on the president's...
You get that? Vote caging? The Tim Griffin, Karl Rove's number two guy, had been involved in vote caging in the last election? This is incredible. I mean, this is a block. Caging is where they mail out, say, get the zip codes of all the African American, predominantly African American areas in a state, and they'll mail a letter that says, "Do not forward, please return." Right. So if the person doesn't live there, it has to come back, and then they'll mail out letters to all of them saying something, you know, just any old thing, right? Vote for Ralph. When the letters bounce back, then they challenge those people when they try to vote. They say, "Oh, you're not there. Or you're not actually registered in that home. Or this is voter fraud. This is their voter fraud thing." And in fact, in a lot of cases, these people are like off serving in Iraq, or they you know, moved last week or whatever. But vote caging is a way of suppressing the vote. It's voter suppression in minority areas. And here she is talking about it. Tim Griffin doing it. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Monica Goodling talking about caging.
Failed to disclose that he had some knowledge of allegations that Tim Griffin had been involved in vote caging during his work on the president's 2004 campaign.
In the 2004 campaign. I tell you, back in the 90s, I owned an advertising agency based in Atlanta. And we had a division of this ad agency. The agency was Chandler McDonald, Stout, Schneiderman, and Poe, and a division of it was the Newsletter Factory. And we did seminars all over the country. We had five people who were trainers, and we did workshops and we did individual consulting for corporations as well as training for groups. You know, these, if you've been in business, you've probably gotten these flyers in the mail, you know, $265 for a one-day seminar kind of thing, and you show up in a hotel room and there's 100 people there and somebody does an all-day training on how to do something, you know, how to do newsletters or how to write ad copy or how to communicate effectively or whatever. I owned a company that did that. And we would drop typically about 2.5 million, 3 million pieces of mail a year. This was all business to business. We were mailing out to businesses. When those when we were testing new lists, we would we would send the mail out in such a way that if it was undeliverable, it came back to us, even though we had to pay for it to come back to us. Because we wanted to know, you know, how clean is the list? How, you know, what in that particular city, what percentage of people have moved? The decisions that you make that, you know, when you're mailing a lot of pieces of mail can mean a whole lot of money if you can just tweak something 0.1%. That mail coming back is that whole process of examining the mail that's bouncing back at you in the direct mail industry is called caging. It's an old, I mean, this is a word that goes back to the 30s. And vote caging is a technique that's used to suppress the political vote. The Washington Post. This is from, you know, literally from the Washington Post here in an article in 2004. Quote, in 1981, the Republican National Committee sent letters to predominantly black neighborhoods in New Jersey, and when 45,000 letters were returned as undeliverable, the committee compiled a challenge list to remove those voters from the rolls. The RNC sent off-duty law enforcement officials to the polls and hung posters in heavily black neighborhoods warning that violating election laws is a crime. In 1986, I'm still quoting from the Washington Post here, in 1986, the RNC tried to have 31,000 voters, most of them black, removed from the rolls in Louisiana. I would add parenthetically that they've now determined a more efficient way to do that, let Katrina do the work and don't rebuild. But in any case, back to the Washington Post, in 1986, the RNC tried to have 31,000 voters, most of them black, removed from the rolls in Louisiana when a party mailer was returned. The consent decrees that resulted prohibited the party from engaging in the so-called anti-fraud, well, actually, the Washington Post doesn't say so-called, from engaging in anti-fraud initiatives that target minorities or conduct mail campaigns to, quote, compile voter challenge lists, end quote. In 1981, they were doing this. In 1986, they were charged with this being a crime, and they have been operating under a consent decree ever since that prohibits them from doing this. And here you have Monica Goodling just in open testimony before Congress, under oath, swearing before God, this graduate of Liberty University, that she's telling the truth, saying that Tim Griffith, the guy who is now the federal prosecutor down in Louisiana, in Arkansas, where Karl Rove's protege, Rove puts him down there in Arkansas so that he can keep a, you know, he can dig up dirt on Hillary Clinton, presumably, that guy was supervising or involved with in some way caging operations for Bush's 2004 election. Well, I want to know, where were those caging operations? Were they going on in Ohio? Did they manage to cage out 150, 200,000 voters maybe in Ohio? Were they going on in Florida? Were they going on in Pennsylvania? Were they going on in New Mexico? Could this account for some of the redshift? I think a lot of the redshift, frankly, has to do with weirdnesses of machines and whatnot. But what's the deal here? Caging. Monica Goodling. Can you play that clip one more time there, Chris? This is
and failed to disclose that he had some knowledge of allegations that Tim Griffin had been involved in vote caging during his work on the president's 2004 campaign. After the deputy's
incredible
public testimony,
she's talking about Paul McNulty. That's Paul McNulty, and she's saying, yeah, he came before Congress, and he lied to you guys, and he didn't tell you everything he knew. I have a feeling Paul McNulty's in for it now. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. A lot on the table, from Venezuela to vote caging to Monica Goodling to the Iraq war debate that's going on, you know, right now. The Democrats are going to split this bill into two pieces. One, the money for the troops, the money to improve veterans' hospitals and things like that, that virtually all the Democrats are going to vote for. I think that's about $17 billion. And two, the actual funding for the ongoing occupation, what everybody in the news refers to as a war. I call the occupation of Iraq. And that one, a lot of the Democrats are going to vote against. And there's going to be a few, you know, conservative Democrats, but it's going to require all the Republicans. And in doing so, they're going to run this as two pieces of legislation so that those two separate votes can be on the record in the House of Representatives. And then they'll combine it into one piece of legislation, send it off to the Senate, where it's going to get real interesting. And you got, you know, senators now saying, well, we haven't seen it yet. We're not sure. But there's a couple of different levels of political calculus going on here. One has to do with the reality that is dawning on Democratic strategists, that this Fox News poll that was reported last night, where people said that the number one issue in their voting decisions, if the vote was held today, would be how things are going in Iraq. In other words, the Republican Party would go down in flames today if the elections were held today. And so the Democratic strategists are realizing, okay, if we succeed in stopping the war, which they would like to do, they genuinely want to do, they want to stop the death and the carnage. But they're being blocked from doing that by George Bush and his veto pen, and not enough Republicans will join them in overriding that veto. So, you know, hey, we can't stop him, and they genuinely can't so far. But actually, you could argue that they could stop him by simply not sending up any funding at all, but that would be political suicide for the Democrats. I mean, that would be, there would be no more Democratic majority after 2008 if they did that. It's real simple. And you know, then you get into this thing of, oh, geez, political suicide versus people dying. Well, I'm in favor. I would come down on the side of voting your conscience. But I can tell you, politicians are politicians, and they're not going to do that. And we have to, you know, I'm just to understand the political calculus here. If the war ends in the spring of 2008, Americans' memories are very short. And the war will not be an issue in the election of 2008, and the Republicans will do well or better than they would, you know. And on the other hand, if the war does not end before 2008, if Bush gets his way, oddly enough, it's going to be a disaster, probably a generational disaster for the Republican Party. The next president will be a Democrat, and the House and the Senate will be Democratic, and you could see us turning back to the reforms of Franklin Roosevelt. So there's this very bizarre, which is worse, the worst of two evils. Another year and a half, and frankly, as I said, most of this is out of control of the Democrats in any case because of the override, you know, the veto override that they lack with the Republicans getting on board. And frankly, I'm predicting that by Christmas, at the very latest, enough Republicans are going to come on board that they're going to then create a veto-proof majority, and they will end the war in the spring because the Republicans realize that it's going to be political suicide not to do it. So it's almost like the whole outcome of this thing is, you know, you can kind of see this how it's playing out. But if the Democrats, on the one hand, well, forget about Democrats and Republicans. If the war continues until 2008, a certain number of people are going to die. Terrible thing. If the war stops before November of 2008, the Republicans may win the White House. They may win back the House or Senate. Who knows? They'll at least keep the power that they have, which will probably mean more Republican wars. It'll probably mean that we'll invade Iran and Syria. You've got people in this party who believe, and as a Christian, I'm horrified by this, but who believe that having a war in the Middle East is the way to bring back Jesus. I mean, you've got all these weird agendas. You've got all the money that's being made by the permanent war industry that is largely aligned with the Republican Party. If the Republicans win, you're going to have 20 years of wars, not a year and a half of wars, 20 years of death and destruction, tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of people dying. Not to mention the billions of people who are already, I mean, half the population of the planet right now, 3 billion people living on less than $2 a day on the edge of starvation. It's going to get worse. So which way would you call it? If you had the choice, if you could just magically say, okay, I'm going to snap my fingers and we're going to have death, destruction, and mayhem for another 16 months or so, and then we'll put a Democratic majority in, this country will return to sanity, and we can start building a world that works for everybody for the entire next generation. Or we're going to end the war right now, and we're going to have 6, 8, 9 months of tranquility, relatively speaking. At least USGIs aren't going to die. But then we're going to have a war in Iraq, in Iran, we're going to have a war in Syria, we're going to have, you know, the Middle East is going to go up in flames, we'll probably attack Venezuela, we'll take out Hugo Chavez, we may confront the Russians, there may even be a nuclear war. Which would you take? I mean, this is the horrible choice that is confronting the Democrats right now. 45 minutes past the hour.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Indeed. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Alice in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Alice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just drove by your window, actually, here in Portland.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm in New York, actually, right now. I'll be in Portland tomorrow morning.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I was going to wave. Anyway, I know I should probably know this. I'm a smart person. I should know my Constitution. But so much of what you're telling me has to do, or what you're talking about with this vote caging, has to do with the fact that the election isn't until November of 08, that we have these two choices to make based on time.
Yeah.
And I hear about in other countries all the time about how you can call elections. Why can't we do that here? I know I should know the answer, but I'm eager to hear
yeah.
you say
well,
why.
You're talking about, for example, in the United Kingdom where they'll just call, or in many countries that have parliamentary forms of government, they'll simply call for a vote of no confidence, or the prime minister will simply say that's it, or they'll ask, in England, I think they ask the Queen to dissolve parliament, and she says, okay, right. We don't have a government anymore. Yeah, and it's sort of like throwing all the cards up in the air. Everybody has to stand for election, and then they rebuild the government from scratch, and you end up with a new prime minister. The reason why we have our elections when we do is because that parliamentary form of government, to a large extent, some parts of it simply weren't chosen by Madison and the people who wrote the Constitution in the Constitutional Convention in 1787. But also because our Constitution specifically says that we will have elections for the House of Representatives every 2 years, for the Senate every 6 years, and for the President every 4 years. It's specified in the Constitution. So the ability, the ability to throw the bums out just isn't there, other than impeachment. They did put that into the Constitution as well. But keep in mind, when this country was put together, when they were putting this thing together, it was the first experiment of its type, and they wanted it to be inherently somewhat stable, because they were coming out of a period of massive instability known as the Revolutionary War. And so that was the highest value, Alice. And you know, it may not be the highest value today, and it would be great if we had the ability to declare, you know, to call for a vote of no confidence, for example, and just say, you know, okay, elections next week.
Well, I think that keeps us from marching out in the streets. We did protest in the millions, it wouldn't do any good. We couldn't change the fact that we have 18 months to wait.
Well, yeah, it wouldn't change the fact that we have 18 months to wait, but it would do a lot of good, because it would change how our elected representatives are voting every day in Congress. And that's that's not a small thing. That they're out there they are the guys who are the men and women who are in front of the parade carrying the flag, and they're looking over their shoulders, paying very careful attention to which way the parade is going down the road. And, you know, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that you know, we have to be part of that. Thanks so much, Alice. I appreciate the call. Kevin in Odenton, Maryland. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. I just want to bring up the fact that neither the Democrats or Republicans bring up the issue of making life better for people in other countries, meaning that these corporations go into these countries, plant their flags there for a couple of years, milk out whatever, and then they disappear.
Yep. And they're doing the same thing here, Kevin. I mean, I think the problem is that so many people are looking at the activity of corporations here. Americans are looking at the activity of corporations right here in America and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we need to do something. And now they're trying to get around Sarbanes-Oxley. They're trying to get around the requirement for openness by going private, increasingly going private. Brian in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a comment on the guy from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Sure. Yarnbrook.
Which is really more of a religion, the way that he exalts the economy above the Constitution. I thought you were going to challenge him on the fact that the Constitution specifies for the common good and that the economic system is really subsumed under that. So the government has to manage the economic system, because if the system is not providing for the common good, then we're not meeting the mission of our country.
Right. And in fact, if you read the preamble to the Constitution, as I recall, I don't have it here in front of me. I have my little pocket Constitution in my studio in Portland. But my recollection is the six items that are listed in the preamble of the Constitution do not include that, you know, the government is here to make sure that you can own private property. But the common, as you say, the common good and promoting the general welfare, those are listed, and it's pretty important stuff. Brian, thank you for the call. Dan in Sacramento, California. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
So you placed a question about, you know, like 20 years of Republican rule if the Democrats decided to speak up and be like, hey, this is wrong, or...
Well, they're already speaking up. If they had the ability to stop the war, which I really don't think they have that ability. Right?
Well, let's just say for the argument that...
Rhetorically, though, yeah.
Right, rhetorically. And that they did, and that was political suicide or whatever, or, you know, 18 months of keeping silent and just going, or not keeping silent, but, you know, going along with however things are going, and how that fits into the NSPD 51, the presidential directive, because they could just, you know, be like, oh, okay, we're just going to go along with this and go along with the election, and then let's say that the Democrats get the majority, but then the president, you know, concocts something that, you know, fits the criteria of the catastrophic emergency.
Right. Then we had the very dangerous window at that point is between the elections in November and the inauguration in January.
Right.
Because then the question becomes, okay, who's really the president if there's a disaster and George Bush, being the president during that time, because a new president hasn't been sworn in, decides to invoke this national security directive, this executive finding, whatever, that the president signed that we talked about yesterday on the program, where Bush basically assumes to himself dictatorial powers. What if he does that during that transition period?
Totally, and that's kind of what I'm worried about, because honestly, like, I've lost a lot of faith in the Democratic Party. They don't seem to have the balls to really, like, stand up and, you know, be for anything. They kind of just play it safe, and they're like, oh, hey, you know, maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't.
I think the Democratic Party has been startlingly aggressive in the last few months, given how, you know, suppressed and oppressed they are. And also, we have to acknowledge, Dan, that you know, it's like trying to herd cats. I mean, you got people in the Democratic Party all over the political spectrum. I would love, just like you would love, for the Democrats to stand up on their hind legs more and speak out more. We need more Russ Feingolds in the Senate. We need more Dennis Kucinichs in the House. But we don't have them right now. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats who are representing districts that are very conservative, in quotes, and it's their job to actually represent those districts. So, 57 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back to the program. And our quote for the day from the Dalai Lama. Peace, he said, in the sense of the absence of war, is of little value to someone who is dying of hunger or cold. It will not remove the pain of torture inflicted on a prisoner of conscience. It does not comfort those who have lost their loved ones in floods caused by senseless deforestation in a neighboring country. Peace can only last where human rights are respected, where the people are fed, and where individuals and nations are free. His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Larry Cox is with us. He's the executive director of Amnesty International USA, amnestyusa.org, the website. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You guys have a new report out.
Yes, we do. We have a report on the work that we're doing and the human rights situation in more than 150 countries around the world.
And But, oh, by the way, something that I meant to mention before I introduced you, let me just point this out to our listeners. As part of our presidential series here on Air America Radio, on Monday this week, we aired our exclusive interview with Barack Obama. On Tuesday, interviews with Hillary Clinton and Governor Bill Richardson. And tonight, please listen for our exclusive interview with former Senator John Edwards, conducted by Mike Papatino on the Rachel Maddow Show tonight. It'll be It'll be on the Rachel Maddow Show tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, Larry Cox, this report, from what I'm reading of what you have, first of all, is today the day that you're releasing it, or is it tomorrow?
Yes.
It's today. So it just came out today. From what I'm reading of it, basically what you're saying is that fear has become one of the major weapons being used around the world, and not by groups that call themselves or that are labeled terrorists.
Well, certainly.
Or not exclusively, by the way.
Not exclusively. That's what's so frightening about the moment we're in the world. I mean, human rights have always been under attack by highly repressive governments, by armed groups that don't really have any commitment to human rights at all. But one of the most frightening things that this report documents is the way that governments who are supposed to be committed to the idea of human rights and to the rule of law have manipulated and used fear to justify their abandonment of those principles and their violation of those principles. And, of course, sadly, the leader in this effort has been the United States.
How so?
Well, the United States, as the superpower, has an incredibly powerful message that it sends out to the rest of the world. And it has been very openly, and the whole world has watched, as in the name of fighting terror, as in the name of security, it has violated fundamental human rights principles, the kinds of violations that we used to associate with the most repressive governments, holding people indefinitely without trial or even without charges. I mean, for years holding people. Disappearing people, sending them to countries where we know that they will be tortured, holding people in secret detention sites is something that I never thought I would live to see the United States openly admit to doing.
Right. Gulags. We're running gulags.
Yes, in a manner of speaking, we are. And we don't know even the extent of it because the information is kept hidden from all of us. We don't know what's going on in those places. We can guess. The president says we are using alternative techniques, which is a very frightening phrase. And the damage is not only what the United States is doing to the particular people it's holding, but the example that the United States gives, the encouragement it gives to dictators and killers around the globe, saying it's all right if you think you have some threat, it's all right to violate the most fundamental principles of human rights. And this has helped to create a world that has become extremely violent and where human rights have begun to deteriorate in significant ways.
Now, in the Bush administration, in the months and years immediately following 9/11, began actively promoting the idea that we should be afraid. In my opinion, I've called this as terrorist activity itself. They have used terror as a political tactic on the American people. Right down to the point where Dick Cheney said, if John Kerry is elected, we will be hit. This, in my mind, is political terrorism. And when the Bush administration started using fear as a political tool in late 2001, ramping it up in 2002 for the elections, and really hammering it hard in the 2004 elections, there were a lot of us, like myself included, who were saying, this is... You know, not only is this a terrible thing for us, not only is this George Orwell revisited, not only is this antithetical to the American principles, the principles on which this country was founded, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all of that stuff. But this is also going to become the new normal for the world.
Well, that's correct.
And that's a horrible thing because we have always been that, to quote Ronald Reagan, quoting a phrase that he stole from John Kennedy, who was quoting a poet, I think it was Robert Frost, that shining city. No, he was quoting John Winthrop, who one of the Puritan founders, that we were the shining city on the hill. Now, Reagan inserted the word shining, but Winthrop just called it the city on the hill. But in any case, we are the standard by which the world goes. And I've been saying this for a long time. Your report seems to be saying this. I'm wondering to what extent it can be quantified.
Well, I don't know how scientifically it can be quantified because there's so many ramifications of this policy. We certainly, you know, we can give you statistics on the extent to which we're holding people indefinitely without trial. We can talk about incidences of torture. But what's hard to quantify is, although we have many, many examples of it, is the extent to which other governments are now using the United States, and just the way you described, using it as justification for their own repressive practices.
Right.
Egypt now is talking about that it's going to legislate permanently its state of emergency laws, which have been now going on for 40 years, and it's citing the Patriot Act as its model.
You know, what's particularly bizarre about that is that Egypt is where the Muslim Brotherhood began. Mr. Qud from Egypt was here in the United States in the late 1950s, early 1960s. He's the guy who went back to Egypt and ultimately was executed. His immediate, he was the mentor of Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was the mentor of Osama bin Laden. I mean, and this all goes back to that state of emergency 40 years ago when Egypt first started crushing human rights.
And you would think we would learn from that, what works and what doesn't work. I mean, it's one thing to recognize and the legitimate fears that people have after something like 9/11 and then do something effective about it to reduce those fears. The problem is that the practices that we've been carrying out have increased have been almost like a recruitment or a propaganda gift to the people who are trying to recruit people who use terror. It has increased the hostility to the United States around the world, and most importantly from our point of view, it's diminished U.S. moral authority. So even in those areas where the U.S. is trying to do something good, for example on Darfur, its moral authority has been so reduced that it's nowhere near as effective as it could be, should be, and once might have been.
Well, and in part because Darfur is the world's worst refugee crisis right now, but the world's second worst refugee crisis, with 2 million external refugees and 2 million internal displaced persons, is Iraq.
Yeah, exactly. No, Iraq is a human rights disaster. And that's the example that the world is watching. And what we're trying to say is not that we shouldn't be doing something effective to protect people from acts of terror or any other assaults on dignity and freedom. But these practices are doing just the opposite.
We're talking with Larry Cox. He's the executive director of Amnesty International USA, amnestyusa.org, the website, a new human rights report out. Larry, why do you think, if you don't mind my asking you to engage in some speculation, if you don't want to go there, if that's fine, I understand, but why do you think the Bush administration is doing this?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not an unusual pattern when you look at the world. Almost every government which has carried out violations of human rights talks about that they're doing it because they're trying to stop a threat to the nation. So it's not unusual. But when you look in depth at it, it's really more about increasing power than it is actually increasing protection. And I think that there's a very clear pattern of using fear of that people had after 9/11 to increase executive power, and we know that the desire to increase executive power existed before 9/11, and that I think 9/11 was seen as an attempt to increase executive power.
Well, it goes all the way back to John Adams, really.
Yes, but this administration in particular has been, not like most governments, has wanted to escape from the restraints that international law and human rights norms impose.
And our Constitution.
And our Constitution.
I mean, let us not forget. I mean, that was the whole point, is the Constitution's there to restrain the power of government in large part.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Larry Cox, AmnestyUSA.org, the website. Check it out, their new human rights report. Larry, great work you're doing. Keep it up.
Well, thank you so much.
16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Reading on my mail, listening on my phone, sneaking and they're peeking, and I'm never quite alone. They're spying and they're prying, but I shouldn't be alarmed. They're only gonna do it to keep me safe from harm. They call it Homeland Security, so they can do the things they do. But I'm not feeling any safer. How about you?
Yeah. Oh, we're all so much safer. Yes, indeed. No, it's really be afraid, be very afraid. Here's the, and sometimes it just gets downright weird. I mean, just downright weird. Sparta, Michigan. Some relatives of mine, my mother's cousin and her husband used to own the airport in Sparta, Michigan. It's, you know, the little dirt strip airport. And I spent a lot of my childhood in Sparta, Michigan. We used to go there and visit all the time. And well, in Sparta, Michigan, this is in the Grand Rapids area where we're on the air on WTKG. There's a guy who was sitting outside a cafe with his laptop, the Union Street Cafe, every day at lunchtime. This guy, Sam Peterson, he'd drive down to the cafe, park his car, and not go into the coffee shop or buy anything, but just sit outside, flip open the top in his laptop, and grab the free Wi-Fi connection that they were offering, and check his email, and surf the web. They busted him. He's facing 5 years in prison. This is a felony. Oh, man, things are getting weird. 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. He apparently, you know, when it actually went to court, it 40 hours of community service and a $400 fine. But, wow. You know, a free Wi-Fi network, and you can get nailed for it. It's pretty startling. Phil in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Phil, thanks for listening to K-Talk, and what's up?
Hey, I'm not disappointed with the Democrats in Congress. I think they've done everything they can. I think what they've really highlighted and pointed out for all the world to see and the American people to see is that President Bush and Vice President Cheney are, they're very clever people, and they're very, very determined people, and they're going to keep us in this Iraqi occupation until the day they leave office.
Right, and the extent to which the Democrats, I mean, basically what they're doing now is they're saying, okay, we've done everything we can now, and if you guys want to maintain this occupation, the Republicans are going to have to step up and vote for it.
Absolutely.
And when the Republicans do, they're going to be claiming ownership of this thing, and which they own anyway, but a lot of them are trying to run from it, like Gordon Smith in Oregon, for example.
Sure, it's an ownership issue, to be sure, but it's also, we really need to make it very clear to the American people that Congress can only do so much here, and impeachment is a political tool, and the American people have to make it very clear to Congress that this is what they want done.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it's really the only remedy left on the table at this point. If the American people want us out,
yep,
the Republicans in Congress and in the White House, and that's Bush and Cheney, they're not getting out. They're not getting out until January 20th of 2009 or whatever day sooner if we can throw them out.
Right. Yeah,
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Phil, for your comments. Well said. Judy in Pasadena. Hey, Judy.
Hello. I just wanted to bring up a subject that I'm really concerned about, and that is the fact that a college student from Liberty University showed up at Jerry Falwell's funeral
with bombs.
With bombs.
Yes.
And he intended to bomb anybody protesting Jerry Falwell's funeral.
Right. And he was not called a terrorist.
Right.
This is the bizarre thing of the American press.
It very much concerns me and upsets me because it's exactly like the madrasas in Pakistan and Afghanistan that are preaching radicalism, religious radicalism. And so it's the same thing going on here, right, yep, in our country.
Yep. And where was the press? Why has the national media not pointed out that this guy is a terrorist? This guy was, yeah, if you're going to use the word, let's use it all the time.
Yep.
Or does it only apply to Muslims?
Yeah, bombing for religious reasons. There needs to be an investigation of what is being taught at Liberty University.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Judy, thank you for calling in, for making that. It's you're absolutely right. Jay in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, Jay. Jay is not there. Mark in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mark. Mark's not there. Parviz in Larchmont, New York. You got to listen to your phone and not the radio, friends. Parviz in Larchmont, New York.
Yes, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Nice to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
And now, There's an ad in the New York Times on May 17th of 2007, the Thursday, last mm-hmm. Thursday, page 813. This was taken by Network of Spiritual Progressives.
Right. It was Michael Lerner, a dear friend of mine, Michael Lerner's organization.
Yeah, yeah. Reverend Tony Campolo. They drafted it. And I want to just bring this to the attention of people and say that they say the war in Iraq is unlikely to end until the Congress passes a law that cuts the funding for the war. Now, American people are not ready to take that step because they don't know what will happen. So this ad says this is how we should follow this after they cut the funding. First, repentance. Apologize to the to the Iraqis and say, sorry, we have caused so much death.
Right. And then we do a new Marshall Plan and we help them rebuild their nation.
And also replace U.S. and British forces with an international peace force. But at the end it says, which I like it, says, when Jesus said, love your enemies, we think he probably meant, don't kill them.
Yeah.
which is great.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, Parviz, you captured the essence of it brilliantly, and thank you for doing that. And I saw that ad in the New York Times, and I probably should have brought it in and riffed on it. There was just so much happening that day, but it was great. It was great to see, you know, the organization that Michael helped birth out there doing that, and I hope that they do a whole lot more of it. And it really is a good formula for bringing peace to Iraq. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Monica Goodling, boy, there's so much going on today. It's incredible. The Democrats are trying to sort out, you know, how they're going to deal with the Bush veto. Frankly, I think that what they should do is say, okay, here's 30, 40, 50 million bucks for, you know, short-term funding. And by the way, included in that is a pay raise for the troops. We're actually going to get them some of the things that they need to survive, the basic survival stuff, and vets. And come back to us again in 3 months, or 4 months, or 5 months, or whatever it is. You know, let's just keep going short on this thing. Is Bush going to veto that? He's got enough money to run until the end of August. You know, how high wire a game of chicken does he want to play? I think the Democrats should really be, you know, taking him on, should play this high wire game of chicken. And I thought it was particularly interesting that Nancy Pelosi, as she's walking into a meeting with Harry Reid, says she's not going to vote for the bill that is going through Congress. She's not going to vote. So we have that. And then perhaps even more, well, not more important, it's hard to say anything's more important than life and death, other than the fact that these partisan political issues are what led to the life and death issue. That is the election of George W. Bush, or the selection of George W. Bush by the Supreme Court, as a consequence of Republican voter caging efforts in Florida in the 2000 election. This is vote suppression. The Republicans claiming that they are trying to stop voter fraud, which is what brings us back to this whole attorney gate purge, the whole Gonzo gate purge. And Monica Goodling just kind of mentioning in passing this morning that Tim Griffith, the guy who used to work for Karl Rove, right underneath Karl, no pun intended, in the White House, now was as a result of this little thing that got slipped into the Patriot Act by Arlen Specter's office. Oh, I didn't even notice. Well, actually, he didn't. He was having chemotherapy. And the guy who slipped it in, used to work on his staff, he's now a federal prosecutor, too, I believe, in Salt Lake City. You know, or in Hatch's territory. Or in Hatch, of course, had the guy working for him who hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer back 4 years ago that never got investigated because the Republicans in Congress just weren't into investigating those kind of things. And now, what, is it too late? Probably. There's enough. I mean, there's just so much going on. Anyhow, Monica Goodlin just happens to mention in passing, and Karl Rove's protege, who's now the federal prosecutor, the U.S. attorney down in Arkansas. Gee, the state that Hillary Clinton lived in all those years. The guy in the perfect position to start doing Ken Starr-type witch hunts. He just happened to be involved in voter suppression caging. This was her first slip.
Failed to disclose that he had some knowledge of allegations that Tim Griffin had been involved in vote caging during his work on the president's 2004 campaign.
So she's talking about Paul McNulty, the assistant to Alberto Gonzalez, failed to acknowledge that he realized that Tim Griffin was involved in caging efforts. So Loretta Sanchez, the congresswoman from California, she says, caging? What's that?
Okay. And the last thing was the voter, the caging issue, which was a reference to Tim Griffin.
Can you explain what caging is? You know, familiar with that term?
My understanding, and I don't actually know a lot about it, is that it's a direct mail term that people who do direct mail, when they separate addresses that may be good versus addresses that may be bad. That's about the best information that I have. It's a direct mail term that's used by vendors in that circumstance.
Now, what I find so interesting here is Monica Goodling's use of the word caging right up front. Because the Republican Party, since 1986, has been operating under a restraining order preventing it from using caging in minority areas or in primarily Democratic areas in order to suppress the vote. And yet that's what they've been doing for the last 6 or 7 years. This is why the Republican Party itself right now should be facing RICO-type charges of organized criminal activity. But here's Monica Goodling coming out and talking about the word caging, just laying it out there. And then when Loretta Sanchez says, well, what's caging, which astounds me that she doesn't know, or maybe it was just a rhetorical question, just a way of getting the testimony on the record. She says, what's caging? And Monica Goodlink, well, I'm not really sure. It's a direct mail tape. Well, it is, as I described in the last hour, it is a technique that is used by direct mail people, ethically and appropriately and legally, to figure out if the mailing list you're sending to is clean. Because you don't want to pay to mail, if you're going to mail to the same mailing list 3 or 4 times, the first time you pay a little bit extra money to have the bounce backs come back to you so you can purge those people off the list so you don't pay to mail to them the second, third, and fourth time. It saves paper, too. I mean, it's a little easier on the planet. That's caging in the direct mail industry. But caging in the Republican Party is sending certified or registered letters to people in predominantly Democratic voting areas, particularly African-American areas. And when those letters don't bounce back, or when those letters do bounce back, rather, because the person decided not to sign for it, because maybe they thought it was a bill that they hadn't paid and they're getting a Dunning's notice, or maybe they just didn't get down to the post office that week, or maybe they weren't, maybe they were in Iraq. I mean, whatever. There's a lot of legitimate reasons why people don't accept certified letters. When those letters bounced back, then the Republicans took those names. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of nationwide, probably millions of names. The BBC laid this all out. A story that Greg Palast did back after the 2000 election about caging in Florida. The 2000 election. Now, here Monica Goodlink says Tim Griffin was involved in 2004 caging in the George W. Bush election in 2004. So the way that she just kind of throws it out really begs the question, and because she's testifying under oath and because her testimony is immunized, I'm really baffled by this. Either she doesn't understand how corrupt the institution and the people in that institution, Gonzalez and Rove and all these guys, how corrupt they are, and what their history of corruption is. Apparently at Liberty University, they never taught, you know, what caging is or, you know, political dirty tricks or what. Either she's completely oblivious of this stuff, which is kind of startling for somebody who is a senior official in the Justice Department. Since the Justice Department is supposed to enforce the law, and part of that is this, you know, restraining order against the Republican Party from doing caging. Either she just doesn't get it at all, or now Monica Goodling is doing cover-up. Now she's doing what Alberto Gonzalez did, which is the, well, if you don't say yes and you don't say no, you know, if you don't say yes, yes, the we did the crime kind of thing, then if you say that, you get in trouble. And if you say no, we didn't, then you could be prosecuted for perjury. So what you say is, I don't know. So is Monica Goodling playing the Alberto Gonzalez game here, the I don't know game? I just find this whole thing just absolutely extraordinary. And this could be, this very well could be the thread that gets pulled on that brings down the whole machine. Because the fact of the matter is that the Republican Party is only, to the extent that it is only in power. And you can take this to the bank, is only in power because of fraud and deception. Fraud and deception by right-wing talk radio, fraud and deception by right-wing phony news, fraud and deception by caging, by manipulation of the electoral process, by massive election fraud, fraud and deception by manipulation of the corporate media. Because when you ask the majority of the American people where they stand and how they feel about the majority of the issues, you find that they are solidly with the Democratic Party or to the, quote, left, end quote, of the Democratic Party, which means that they're really the middle. They're really us. So I just find this fascinating. Bob in New York City, got about a minute before we've got to take a break here. Bob, what's up?
I just wanted to talk about, I think there's a lot of things that Congress can do, the Democrats, short of cutting off the funding.
To stop the occupation of Iraq by
stop the
United States.
War. One thing is, you know, under the No Child Left Behind law, there's a provision which gives military recruiters student contact information, their phone numbers, et cetera. This is in the high schools. There's something similar in the colleges called the Solomon Amendment.
Right. It's an opt-out program.
Right.
You have to tell them that you want to opt out, but they're automatically
I think that's Mike Honda, is it, in California, who has a bill which wants to change opt-out into opt-in.
Right. Yeah, there have been a number of efforts to do that ever since that was first passed. None of them have been successful.
Very, very, very useful to push that bill forward. It sort of gives new meaning to the word No Child Left Behind.
I agree it would be a really good thing to move the bill forward, but it's not going to end the occupation of Iraq. You know,
But it's going to make it much harder for the military to recruit, you know, young students to go into the military.
Yeah, good point, Bob. Yesterday or the day before, I heard somebody say, and I don't remember where, what circumstances were, that the first two people who died in Iraq were illegal immigrants who had joined the military in order to get legal status in the United States. I want to check that out. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
We know what it's all about. He lied to get us into war. He'll lie to get us out. Fool us one more time, like no one's keeping score. Election fraud should be a crime. Don't let them do it anymore. Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat, here we go again. Ohio and Florida, where losers go to win. Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat, no one dares to say that's two elections in a row. They're laughing all the way.
And Monica Goodling coming clean about it today before Congress, although she didn't even realize what she said, apparently. That's absolutely fascinating. Yes, Tim Griffin in charge of caging in the 2004 election for George W. Bush, not realizing, apparently, that the Republican Party operating under a court order back from 1986 preventing them from this voter suppression technique that may have suppressed as many as, according to Mark Crispin Miller in his book Fooled Again, and Greg Palast in some of his writings, as many as 4 million votes suppressed in the 2000 and 2004 elections. Victoria Jones with us from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Good morning or good afternoon or whatever. Yeah, it's afternoon here on the East Coast, Victoria. How are you?
I'm very well, Tom. Thanks. How are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. I'm going to sleep in my own bed tonight.
Oh, so that's always a good thing.
I'm looking forward to it. And seeing Louise again, too. I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, so, I'm sure you are.
So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, Monica Goodling's happening in Washington, D.C. Everyone's all the Twitter about this because, you know, she is the event of the day that we've been anticipating for some time. And she does have immunity, at least immunity as long as she tells the truth.
Right.
But she's speaking so fast that it's going to be very difficult, unless she's the most incredibly honest person on the planet, for her to stay incredibly honest. Because when you speak that fast, at some point something's going to slip out that isn't absolutely 100% there. And she's just babbling, quite frankly. But
maybe she's actually trying to tell the truth.
And she could well be. She could well be. And now, she really has admitted that political affiliations involved in hiring and firing within the Department of Justice.
Right. She confessed to a crime in that regard. I should have mentioned that earlier, too. It is a crime to use politics as it's a violation of, is it the Smith Act, the Hatch Act? I forget which one.
But she talks about the law and the rules. She used both those phrases. But she seemed to refer more often to the rules. She seems to have thought it was a violation of the rules. She doesn't seem to have gotten that it was a violation of the law.
Right. See, this is something that really concerns
me. She's only a lawyer.
Well, she's also a graduate of Liberty University, where apparently if you think that people are going to show up and protest, you make bombs and take them.
Exactly.
I mean, what are they teaching in this school?
Not much, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, here is somebody who was promoted, what, 5 times in the Justice Department? She got 5 promotions?
Yeah, she's pretty well.
She's right up there. She's like in the top 10 people in the Justice Department. And she doesn't understand the difference between law and rules?
No, apparently she doesn't.
That's amazing.
And so far, from what she said, why did she need immunity for any of this?
Well, because she confessed to a crime, although she's saying that she doesn't realize it's a crime.
Well, then why would she need immunity?
That's a good question.
You see, that's not really clear to me about any of this.
Yeah, this is what I was wondering out loud in the last segment about these caging lists, because she said that Tim Griffin, the Karl Rove protege who was installed under that little slipped-in provision for the Patriot Act that allows the president to get around congressional certification of appointees, confirmation, was installed as the attorney general, as the federal prosecutor for Arkansas, so that he could presumably, so he could dig up dirt on Hillary Clinton if she becomes the Democratic nominee. That Tim Griffin was involved in caging operations for the Republican Party in the George W. Bush campaign in 2004. Apparently not realizing that caging is a crime. It's a major crime. I mean, we're talking election fraud, massive election fraud by the Republican Party that the Republican Party has been forbidden by law since 1986 from engaging in.
I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing that I might not know is a crime, but, you know, my knowledge of the law is that I don't go over, you know, 30 miles an hour in certain areas.
Right.
and that's, I know that on a good day.
Yeah.
I didn't go to Liberty University.
Yeah, well, it's...
Maybe that's just as well.
Yeah, and there's 150 more Monica Goodlings in the Justice Department right now, another 150 attorneys from Liberty University who are working in our
really?
Justice... Yeah, that's the total number within the administration. Of Liberty University graduates. Liberty University brags about it on their website. So what else is going on?
Just very briefly, what we haven't learned much about, we have learned very little about the White House involvement, and we've learned very little about Karl Rove's involvement.
Right. Yeah, she seems not to have known about those things. My guess is that Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez were the hitmen here. This thing has been run like a mafia operation, particularly after what we saw with Comey's testimony week before last.
Yes.
What's happening with the Iraq funding, the Iraq occupation funding?
Well, it looks like it's going through. Nancy Pelosi will vote against it. They have the votes for it to go through, and it's going to happen. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's not complicated, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to go down, and there are going to be a lot of people on the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party who are very unhappy with this. It's going to be very interesting to see how the White House plays it, whether it tries to take the high road and talk about everybody working together, or whether it decides to gloat. My guess is that it's going to try and take the high road and talk about everybody working together. And there will be another opportunity in the, I think it's called the Defense Appropriations Bill, but I could have my names wrong, coming up in a few months' time, for the Democrats to try and tie up the funding.
Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that between now and the Senate vote is Memorial Day in between, right?
That's right.
And a lot of members of Congress are going to go back home to their home districts. They're going to show up at Memorial Day events. They're going to get out there, and they're going to be hearing from their constituents. And I have a feeling that a lot of them are just going to be absolutely catching hell. I'm not sure that this thing is going to make it through the Senate. What you think it does? I mean, is that the official word that they've got the numbers?
I think they've just about got the numbers. And then, of course, we've got Joe Lieberman.
Yeah, who's now talking about becoming a Republican.
And who I think probably will.
Oh, man, which would flip the Senate.
Flip the Senate.
Holy cow. See, that's the way that George Bush guarantees that he stays in power forever, is he buys off Joe Lieberman, and then he can't be convicted. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Speaking of smart people, special thanks to the folks in the chat room and the many folks who sent me emails pointing out that it's not Liberty University that Monica Goodling graduated from. It's Regent University with 150 graduates in the Bush administration. That's Pat Robertson's law school. You can't keep the right-wing nutcase colleges separate. You know, it's just, I'm sorry. Sometimes they just, they all kind of blur into one. It was Liberty University who trained the guy who went to Jerry Falwell's funeral with a bomb. With a bunch of bombs, apparently. And that's different from Regent University, another Christian college, which is connected to Pat Robertson, which has is the godfather, which gave legal birth to, as it were, Monica Goodling. Not a whole lot of difference, but, you know, keeping our facts straight, an important thing. And so thanks to everybody who, you know, I find it gratifying, frankly, that when I misstate something on this program, and it happens from time to time, I mean, we're all human here, that people are so quick to correct me because they expect a certain level of integrity and factualness, you know, in the program. And I honor that, and I think it's a value that's held by our listeners. Well, I know it's a value that's held by our listeners, and I just, you know, so thanks a lot for setting me straight. Ms. Goodling got her degree from Regent University, not Liberty, and on it goes. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, the third hour of our program here. At the bottom of the hour, in about 10 minutes, we're going to be talking with Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org. I'm sorry, we're going to be talking with our friend Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com, formerly the CIA and the State Department. And then after that, I've got to hop on a plane and fly back to Portland. And so I'm going to fly out of here, and we're going to play an interview that I did recently with Congressman Earl Blumenauer that I think you'll find very interesting. And the very last segment will be a repeat of our last segment from yesterday, which I thought had some really useful and interesting information and is worth repeating. If you're going to do a best of, might as well do it as a relatively fresh one and a good one. As part of our presidential series, by the way, Air America's presidential series, on Monday this week, Air America aired our exclusive interview with Senator Barack Obama. On Tuesday, our exclusive interviews with Senator Hillary Clinton and Governor Bill Richardson. Tonight, check out our exclusive interview with former Senator John Edwards, conducted by Mike Papantonio on the Rachel Maddow Show tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can also find it over at AirAmerica.com. You'll be able to track that thing down. So that's the last hour of the program, how it's going to play out. And Steve in Rhode Island, you are live and on the air. What's up, Steve?
Hey, Tom. You know, about a year ago, I started wondering what was in it for Joe Lieberman to be kissing up to the Republicans and Bush the way he was. And then I noticed all along the way that him and McCain were really good pals. Then you heard McCain in the debate when they asked him if he could get along with, a Democrat. He said, yeah, Lieberman, Lieberman, Lieberman. I'm wondering if the fix isn't in. Now he's talking about becoming a Republican. I'd like to start a rumor that he has been promised McCain's vice presidential spot if McCain's the nominee. What do you think?
That's an interesting one. That's a very interesting one. Or maybe even, I'm not even sure necessarily that he would want to run for vice president again. He might. He might very much want to. He may also have been promised something like Secretary of State. Or, you know, something like that.
You know, he was content to be a vice presidential candidate once already.
Yeah, yeah, although it is a pretty grueling thing. Maybe he loved it. I don't know. But he's certainly been promised something. Many of Joe Lieberman's behaviors have gone beyond the realm of ideological integrity. He's taken positions and he's voted in ways that are inconsistent with anything that you could argue is simply pure ideology, and it's become partisan, and it's become partisan by and large, well, not by and large, to some extent in a very Republican way. And just a couple of days ago, he was apparently encouraging speculation that he might flip to the Republican Party. I think at the very, very least, Steve, what's in it for him is power and money. I mean,
well, if he's the vice presidential nominee, you heard it here first.
Yeah, okay. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting. Dorothy in Raymond, Washington. Hey, Dorothy.
Hi. I was listening to C-SPAN this morning and got in on the tail end of Kucinich's speech, which was great, and he laid out how under this latest bill the administration is trying to pass forces the Iraqi government to privatize the oil.
Right, this is one of their benchmarks.
Yeah.
It's not entirely privatization. It's these production sharing agreements, but the effect is the same. The government ends up with about 17% of the revenue. The rest of the revenue goes to the oil companies, whereas in some other many other countries where you have partnerships, public-private partnerships, the oil company gets say half of it, and the government gets half, you know, that kind of thing, or variations on a theme. And you know, Chavez is talking about 60%. You know, he's going to take 60%, give 40% to the oil companies. But in the case of Iraq, 17%.
It's not morally right to do that.
It's not. The justification is that in a country where it's difficult to function and there's no infrastructure, the oil companies are going to have to put a whole lot of money in up front. That justification may wash in some countries and in some parts of the world, but frankly, I don't think it washes at all in Iraq. Iraq already has a good oil infrastructure, number one. And number two, because Iraq's oil resources are largely unexploited because they haven't been drilling, you know, they haven't been pumping enormous quantities of oil out of Iraq for a long time like they have been in Saudi Arabia, for example, it's really cheap oil. The harder you have to suck on the straw, the more expensive the oil is. And as the wells get, you know, down toward that 50% point and then below that, you have to suck harder and harder on that straw. So producing oil in the United States, for example, in many areas, you know, it costs $5, $10, $15, in some cases $20, $30, $40 a barrel to produce oil because you've got to put that much energy into the pump that's going, you know, that's pulling that oil out of the ground. On the other hand, the Iraqi oil is so relatively virgin, it's so new, it's so untapped, most of it, and particularly these new oil fields, that the average cost of producing oil in Iraq is around $1.50 a barrel. So it is some of the most profitable oil in the world. And, again, another reason why these guys are going after it. Rich in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you, you know, unlike, it's nice that you correct yourself, unlike the right-wing noise pollution, you know, that we get in this country. What you were saying about Monica Goodling, I'd wonder, I hope you're, I'd like to see that you're right, that you would, that could be the straw that breaks the back and brings down the administration.
Well, if her discussion of caging, and this is, Rich, this is what's going to be really fascinating to watch, is if her discussion of caging makes the evening news. Now, keep in mind Comey's testimony, and one of these days, tomorrow or maybe even next week, I'm gonna take a second. There's a 20-minute piece of testimony of Comey that we can probably chop down to about 17 minutes, but that's an eternity in radio. But I want to play the whole thing because it is, you know, I'll break it up with commentary, but it is breathtaking. It is breathtaking, this guy describing what happened in John Ashcroft's hospital room. It is riveting drama. And that was not even reported by ABC and CBS. Not even reported. And this was in open testimony in Congress. It's not like they couldn't get a reporter there. It's not like, you know, well, we can't go out of the green zone, so we can't report on what's going on. You know, it's not like that. I mean, this is... So if her use of the word caging, and if that interchange between her and Loretta Sanchez about caging becomes a stepping off point for the national media, for the corporate media in the United States, to talk about how the Republican Party has been using caging since the early 80s, ever since the Reagan administration. This started in 1981. At least we started knowing about it in 1981. This came with the Reagan administration, who brought in guys like, Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl. And in any case, if the mainstream media uses this as an opportunity to point out what caging is and how our elections have been distorted, how election theft has occurred in the United States as a result of caging, if they do that, it will be a high water point. It'll be an Edward R. Murrow moment for the media in the United States. And it's going to be real. I want all of you to watch the news tonight on all the major networks and see how this thing plays out. And if they don't mention the fact that the Republican Party has been operating under this restraining order and all the crimes that have been committed around caging, if they don't, call them up and give them hell. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, flag on the wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore.
21 minutes past the hour. I'm coming up on 22 any minute here. Larry Johnson's with us. NoQuarter.typepad.com, his blog. Larry Johnson, former Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. State Department officer with the Department of Counterterrorism, expert in the fields of terrorism, aviation security, crisis and risk management, and an all-around good guy. Larry Johnson, welcome to the program.
Very generous, Tom, as always.
Well, you did the hard work in secret, and you're doing the hard work out in public, and I'm curious which is actually harder.
The stuff in government's harder simply because it's so maddening to be caught in a bureaucracy.
Ah, yeah, okay, I can understand that. Having worked with a few, both corporate and government bureaucracies,
right.
I mean, bureaucracy is bureaucracy wherever you find it. You've blogged about a number of things recently over at noquarter.typepad.com, and one of them is this disaster with the delivery of food and things in Iraq and whatnot. What's at the top of your list?
That right now is probably one of the most disturbing warning signs about how badly the surge is going. and how much at risk our troops are. Pat Lang got a hold of, Pat's a retired Army colonel. He used to be head of the Middle East Division of DIA. And someone sent him a memo that was just issued on Monday over in Iraq. And it's notifying everybody that, hey, you know, don't expect much fresh food, and you're only going to get two hot meals a day instead of three or four, and everyone's required to eat MREs because we're having trouble with our supply lines.
And by the way, you got to stay there 15 months instead of 14, and then 14 instead of 13, and 13 instead of 12, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
This goes to the heart of the ability of the U.S. military to sustain itself in the field. They have been dependent upon the movement of trucks coming up from Kuwait to the various bases in Iraq. So the fact that they're not able to move enough food right now to sustain the U.S. troops that are deployed there is a sign that, you know, when your logistics breaks down, your army does march on its stomach, and the fact that you can't keep them properly fed is a sign that of how overstretched they are.
If you go back and you look in history, particularly the more recent history, the 19th century, the 18th century, some of the wars, the Napoleonic Wars, the wars in Russia, you find that when armies got, when their supply lines got cut off and they got caught, and they started, they typically started taking food from the local economy and the locals. And very often that was not possible because in the process of the military campaign itself, it cut off the food supplies to the locals. The locals were already starving.
Right.
I mean, are we looking at a situation here where our GIs are in a way kind of a microcosm to the macrocosm, that the inability to feed them is a reflection of the inability of Iraq to feed itself in some ways?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what's even more disturbing about this is when you put this in conjunction with, over the last couple of months, we've seen attacks on bridges in Baghdad itself, and a couple of those bridges have been brought down. In discussions with another senior military officer who's just come back, the thinking there is that what we're actually seeing is an insurgent campaign. They're going to block and drop these bridges. They're going to isolate U.S. forces in various parts of the capital, and then at that point they will launch, let's call it a Tet-style offensive, where they will mass force, come against entrenched U.S. positions and overrun them. And by blocking and destroying these bridges, they've now routed U.S. response forces, the quick reaction forces, to have to come into special, you know, very restricted lanes where they can be ambushed.
This is the situation that the French faced in Algeria, the French faced in Vietnam, that the British faced in Uganda. There's a lot of precedent for this kind of thing.
Yeah, this is going to get uglier. I mean, what we've seen is, despite the so-called surge underway, the level of casualty rates among U.S. soldiers has increased, not diminished. And even more disturbing, if any of your listeners have seen the front page of the Washington Post today, where they've leaked information about a so-called Plan B that's under consideration, that plan is going to require 300,000 to 400,000 troops. And yet, the people leaking this plan say, we cannot sustain 140,000 troops in the field until through spring. We can't go beyond that. Yet the proposal of their plan, which is going to be securing Iraqi citizens, to do that, you're going to need more troops. I mean, we're seeing a complete breakdown in the U.S. government on this, a complete,
right,
utter breakdown.
Well, what you're seeing is a delusional White House, on the one hand, and a bunch of enablers in various federal agencies. I'm curious where Mr. Gates, you and I remember when he was being confirmed, I was very wary of Mr. Gates for a variety of reasons, and you were a very enthusiastic about him. I'm wondering, first of all, how you think he's doing as Secretary of Defense, and secondly, you know, where you think his position is on this, and in about 15 seconds here, Larry.
I think he's doing okay, but he's not going to be a Jerry Bremer. He's not going to burn his reputation to go down on this sinking ship.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Larry Johnson. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you guys.
NoQuarter.typepad.com. Check it out. 27 minutes past the hour. Earl Blumenauer up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
34 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, supported by you, listening for local sponsors that you can support and letting them know that you're listening to the program and using their products, plus our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time at sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics at smalldog.com, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Congressman Earl Blumenauer from the 3rd District of Oregon, what Stephen Colbert last night referred to as the ugliest district.
Ouch, Tom.
I know. He was so nice to you when you went out. He didn't even make you hold a sausage like he did to Brian Baird. Anyhow, Congressman, great to have you with us. You are, along with a few other members of Congress, as I recall, the congresswoman from California, refresh my memory, introducing this.
This is Jan Schakowsky from Chicago.
Jan Schakowsky. From Chicago, yes.
And Chris Shays, Republican from Connecticut.
Right. Introducing a piece of legislation to allow up to 15,000 Iraqis and their families to enter the U.S. legally each year for the next 4 years. Right now, what is the situation? We go over to their country, we blow it up, we basically open the gates of hell, and then when they say to us, you're here to help us, well, those of us who have helped you guys who are really at risk, both sides are taking aim at them. Can we come live in your country? We say no. Is that about what's going on?
It's unfortunately, your thumbnail sketch is too accurate. This is the scene of, other than Darfur, the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world today. We have 4 million Iraqis who've been uprooted from their homes, 2 million that have had to move around in other places in Iraq, 2 million that have fled the country already, 50,000 to 70,000 more people each month. And the United States has basically slammed the door on people, as you say, whose lives are at risk because they helped Americans. Since October, the great United States of America that did unleash this horrible series of events in Iraq has allowed only 69 Iraqi refugees, only one last month. It's absolutely outrageous. I've been working with some people in Oregon. Actually, there was a high school class, some of the Oregon National Guard members who tried to get their interpreter out, a young woman whose life was definitely at risk, and it took months to jump through the hurdles and get her here to safety. This is something that I feel, no matter what their idea is about the war in Iraq or where they think it's going, they ought to be able to unite to give simple justice to these refugees.
What kind of support or resistance are you getting in Congress to this idea?
Well, actually, we've just started circulating the information this week. There have been a number of newspaper and magazine articles, reports that are coming out, and we're finding that there are a number of people who just simply, it wasn't on their radar screen. They didn't realize, unless they had direct experience in their district, they didn't realize how bad it was. And I'm finding significant expressions of support. We've got a number of international organizations that are stepping up. We even, the Iraqi ambassador to the United States wasn't able to get to our press conference this morning, but submitted a statement in support of it. I think we're going to be able to make a difference here.
That's great. That's great. I'm curious about Jan Schakowsky is one of your co-sponsors on this from Chicago, and she also just recently came out in support of Denis Kucinich's suggestion or his bill to impeach Dick Cheney. There are only 4 supporters of that in Congress right now. I was a big supporter of impeachment for a long time, and I'm beginning actually to become ambivalent about it. I'm concerned that George Bush and Dick Cheney aren't the problem anymore. It's the Republican Party and the organized crime element within it I mean that quite seriously.
I know you do.
Many of your Republican colleagues are good people. Ron Paul is a man of the highest integrity, for example. He's been on this program, and I have a lot of respect for him. I disagree with him, but I have a lot of respect for him. But there are other elected officials, probably a few Democrats as well, but in particular a number of Republicans who are behaving in ways that we used to see in movies about the mafia. And I think that needs to be pointed out. And I'm just curious what your take is on Jan Schakowsky's support of Dennis Kucinich and where you are at on that.
I have felt all along that if Congress started to exercise its legitimate oversight function and holding these people accountable for everything from abuses for contracting in Iraq to what I think is a scandal that is of significant proportion that is growing in terms of the interference with the administration of justice, with Alberto Gonzalez and the firing of U.S. attorneys, that we would set the table for, in some cases, there will be prosecution. We've already seen, there are 8 members of Congress on the Republican side of the aisle that are under investigation. Tom DeLay was whining in the newspapers yesterday about the zealousness of the FBI.
Yeah, he's compared himself to Jesus Christ.
It's
beyond bizarre.
We have a situation where we've had a number of officials in the Bush administration now that are resigning. I think the spotlight on the actual performance that the investigation work that Henry Waxman and other committees are doing is really turning up the heat and is making a difference. As a practical matter, there is so much support still from the Republican base and the Republicans in the Senate that an impeachment activity would go nowhere. And if I'm Karl Rove, I would rather change the subject to impeachment that's not going to go anywhere rather than have the searchlight on activities that lead actually to my office, Karl Rove, as well as others. So from my vantage point, I'd like us to keep the heat. I'd like us to do our job with oversight. I'd like us to lead these activities along to wherever the evidence takes us. And I think it's going to continue to show more and more results. It's made a difference already.
Yeah, and who knows where it'll lead. I mean,
absolutely.
When the 33 years ago when the House Judiciary Committee voted to subpoena the White House tapes, only one of the Republicans voted in favor of that. And 4 months later, virtually all of the, not all, but nearly all the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee voted in favor of articles of impeachment against Nixon once they heard the evidence.
It's a very important point, Tom. And I think what we're seeing now is so many moving pieces here. We're watching the Republicans feeling the searing heat on the Iraq War and their little visit to the White House, but they're more and more informal talks. They are feeling very uncomfortable for their strong support for the administration. It's starting to crack. And these investigations that are taking place, the work that the media is doing, and the American public's attitude is making a big difference as well. I think between now and the end of the year, people will be stunned at where all this leads, and I don't want to do anything that disrupts it.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. We were just speaking with an attorney with the Brennan Center who is focusing their efforts, an organization that's focusing their efforts on habeas corpus. Our habeas corpus rights, which date back to 1215, the Magna Carta, were stripped out stripped away from citizens of the United States in violation of Section 9 of Article 1 of the Constitution by the John Warner Defense Authorization Bill of 2007. They're not put back into the 2008 Defense Authorization Bill. I understand that the Democratic Caucus is talking about putting it forward a standalone bill to restore habeas corpus rights here in the United States and wherever we may have, jurisdiction of a territory. What do you know about that? What's your position on that?
Well, I support it. I have been just appalled at the chipping away at fundamental freedoms of American citizens, the notion that we are also going to put enemy combatants in some sort of legal limbo, undercutting our moral authority, has always struck me as being repugnant. I am confident that we're either going to have amendments that will restore it when it allow that vote when it comes to the floor, or standalone legislation. And part of what's going on, frankly, is that there is just so much activity, and that these people have done so much damage over the last 6 to 12 years, depending on what the subject is. You know, I'm calling you right now from the floor of the House because I have to vote in about 2 minutes. I'm looking right out of this phone booth, and Henry Waxman is right across the aisle from me in a phone booth taking furious notes. Henry and I have talked about this. There's so much that he's trying to keep track of, to trying to stay on top of, that it's astounding. So part of the issue here is trying to sequence and do this in a way that we can give appropriate attention to it. I know lots of your listeners and lots of the people that I represent are frustrated because they'd like more to happen, but this is it's going to take us a while to get all these pieces back in place.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to take all that much time. I hope not on this one.
Yeah,
I really see the direction with good people like you in the Congress moving in the right direction. Congressman Earl Blumenauer from the 3rd District of Oregon, blumenauer.house.gov. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the best of Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Friends. By the way, in the chat room, AJ in the chat room says, here's a toll-free number for Capitol Hill. These things come and go, so here's one that apparently is working right now. 1-877-851-6437. If you want to call your member of Congress toll-free, 877-851-6437. And I'll repeat that again in just a moment. Mark in Maine, welcome to the program. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right, but what's up?
I'm just so enervated by this whole debate. It's not honest.
Which debate are you talking about?
Well, the fact of pulling the troops out and the Democrats not standing up to...
Oh, the funding bill.
Yes, I'm sorry. I wasn't clear.
Yeah.
My point is this. We have appropriated in the last spending bill, the one before, $550 million to build Embassy Baghdad on 104 acres, 21 buildings. Do you ever hear anyone on the floor talking about this? And I ask this question because if I made any expense like that in my life, I certainly would want to protect it. I don't want the troops over there, but I don't think the debate is honest. They all know that if they pull the troops out, that is going to be beaten like a piñata. And just like in Iran, they'll attack it, and they need to protect it. And that is not being discussed. We're big adults. We're adults. We can handle the truth. So why don't they say, American people, this is why we're not pulling the troops out. We made this huge investment, and what do you expect us to do? We were fooled into it, but here we are. Am I wrong?
I don't know, Mark. I really don't know. And I think for if you were to talk to a dozen different Democrats, you'd probably get a dozen different answers. I don't think the fact that we have this huge embassy project going on is the, you know, any kind of major motivator I just don't know. I it concerns me, frankly.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah,
I'm just wondering, it's a waste of money, it seems like to me, though.
Well, time will tell. A lot is going to depend on how the Iraqi government shakes out and how badly the Middle East goes down. I mean, what we were seeing in Lebanon and all these kinds of things. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to be very concerned about what's going on in the Middle East. And if we could play a role there as as a stabilizer, this may be a very good thing. My concern is that I don't think it's possible for us to play a role there as a stabilizer, particularly after what George Bush has done. I think our role in the Middle East is going to be largely or perhaps even purely inflammatory. But time will tell. I just don't know. But to your point about, you know, being disappointed about the Democrats not standing up on the funding bill, I think that that's a good one. And again, it illustrates the point that I keep making on this program, and it really is one of the central, you know, core values, beliefs that I hold about the importance of participation in democracy in the United States. It goes back to, for example, you know, Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is not the person who would be my first choice for president right now. I have some vague preferences with regard to the primaries. She wouldn't be at the top of the list. But if she were the nominee for the Democratic Party right at this moment versus any of the Republicans on the Republican side, I would vote for her, and I would campaign for her to the extent that I felt comfortable doing that. And here's why. Not because I agree with her on all the issues, but because I believe that if enough of us get active in the Democratic Party, if enough of us help work together inside the Democratic Party, and I'm talking about even people who consider themselves Greens and progressives, as in the Progressive Party in Vermont and things like that, it is possible to participate in both. You can be both, active with the Green Party and the Democratic Party. If enough of us are there, if the parade gets big enough, then Hillary or whoever's at the head of the parade will say, okay, this is the direction we're going. And that's what we've been seeing for the last 4 months in Congress. And the fact that the Democrats seem to be backing away right now from George Bush trying to call their bluff simply demonstrates to me that not enough of us are speaking out to them. And I think that this congressional recess is frankly going to help them get their backbone back. And we're going to see more Republicans at the same time coming forward and saying, no, this isn't going to fly, because they're going back to the districts and they're hearing from people there as well. But the core thing is, you know, show up. If your member of Congress is doing a town hall meeting, whatever, show up, call them, give them a call and let them know what you think. Gene in Napa, California. Hey, Gene.
Tom, thank you for covering these presidential directives 51 and 20. I can't help but challenge the intent behind them. I feel no reassurance that Chertoff being given more power is when he had clear disregard for the people's welfare after Katrina.
Right, and I'm wondering if this is what Rumsfeld was doing, sitting in that office with 35 people in the Pentagon for the last 3 months or however long it's been since he left.
You know, if Bush uses the coming hurricane season to implement these new powers, the irony is Bush will grab total power because of what he said was not real, global warming.
What do you mean?
Well, that's why we're having these terrible hurricanes, is global warming. The Earth trying to cool itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just awful. And then...
So there's a certain irony there, but, yeah.
Yeah, and then this cooperative effort that you quoted, does that mean that anybody who disagrees is not cooperative and so punishable? It's frightening.
You mean in the presidential directive?
Yes.
Yeah, as far as my read of this, and again, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not the ultimate expert on this, but I've been reading an awful lot of expert opinion on the Internet. And again, the Internet isn't always the most reliable source either, but it's time for us to have a national conversation about this. I mean, there's this entire commission out there that is looking into doing this kind of thing, and to have George Bush just kind of going around it. In fact, you can see it at continuityofgovernment.org. I mean, there's this commission, and this is not that. This is George Bush saying, "I, Claudius." It's just too totally weird. So yes, we've launched Air America 2.0, and thanks so much for being with us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the best of Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.